The first case in our calendar is 03-1904, State of Ohio versus Darrell Ferguson. Mr. Krim.
Good morning, Your Honor. I would like to reserve 8 minutes for rebuttal, please.
Watch your time there.
May it please the court. I am here on behalf of Darrell Ferguson. Mr. Ferguson was involved in 3 homicides in Dayton, Ohio around Christmas of 2001. The issue before this court is the issue of competency to waive mitigation and to plead guilty. Dayton has had 2 cases on those issues in recent times, and I have been the attorney for the appellant on both cases. The Mink case, which was decided after I wrote the appellant's brief, but before I wrote my reply brief. So these cases have been treated in some ways quite similarly, both at the trial court and at the appellate level. There are, however, some significant differences between the 2 cases, and that's what I wish to focus on this morning. They're both factual and legal differences. The Mink case, the court had before it very minimal information about the psychiatric history. Because there was relatively little psychiatric history. The court in this case had before it the reports from the clinical psychologist, but also an affidavit from a psychiatrist. The legal information that the court had before it was significantly greater in this case. The other thing the court had before it was the constant request by Mr. Ferguson for a psychiatrist to participate in the evaluation. Mr. Ferguson's first encounters with the mental health system go back to 1985. He has been treated for a variety of conditions since that time. He was on a variety of medications at the time of the homicide, well, shortly before the homicide, within a few days before the homicides. He was on medications while in the jail. At some point, he stopped taking the medications, but he was still under the prescriptions. His physician was he was treated until his arrest by a pediatric neurologist in Dayton, Ohio.
Counsel, I believe there's some indication that he committed these crimes to get funds for crack, or is that a mistake?
I don't recall exactly. I think he was getting them for, he was using some kinds of drugs. I'm not sure whether it was crack or toluene at this point.
This court is always trying to carefully analyze how you sort out these mental health issues. But doesn't it become ever so much more complicated if there is some medication that is keeping one on an even keel, taken or not taken, and then mixed with powerful drugs of abuse, self-inflicted destruction of one's mental capacities, and how are we to sort that out?
Well, it would seem to me that having expert testimony from someone who is experienced at dealing with the effect of chemicals on the brain would be helpful to the court, both at the trial level and at this level. Mr. Ferguson asked for that kind of advice, and the court rejected it ultimately. The trial court did.
Well, there was an evaluation, but it was not of the caliber that the defense counsel was seeking.
No, the affidavit from the psychiatrist was an affidavit that was prepared for certain kinds of testing. And the psychiatrist said, before I can give an opinion, I need these kinds of tests, a neurological test. neuropsychological testing. There were some indications about brain damage, both from the use of toluene and other chemicals, as well as participation in street fighting. So there are certain kinds of psychological tests that could be conducted that can look at that. He was looking for a particular kind of an EEG, I believe, based on an abnormal reading that had occurred earlier in Mr. Ferguson's medical history. There were two other tests, and I'll get to them in just a second.
Some sort of spinal tap or something?
Yes,
like that.
Yeah, which is, an analysis of the the chemical analysis. A lot of psychiatry these days, the neurologists and the psychiatrists are moving together in their approaches to how to study these things. There was a fourth test, which I don't have in my notes. Oh, a PET scan. Again, that's a general examination of the brain. They take it's like an X-ray, only it uses a more sophisticated kind of technology.
But the fundamental issue upon which you seek reversal of, is it just the sentence, is that he was not, that he didn't get the evaluations necessary to do properly determine whether or not he was competent to be engaged in the sentencing phase of the case. Is that?
I believe it would go back even to the sentencing and plea phase were very close together. There wasn't. This was where he solicited and was allowed to plead guilty. So my guess is it would have to go back. The competency determination was based on an examination by a clinical psychologist in May of, I believe, 2002, and the plea and hearing on mitigation the hearing on sentencing was held in September.
Okay, so which is it? Which are you arguing?
I'm arguing both, Your Honor.
Doesn't this fly in the face of the actual hearing, though, by the three-judge panel? Or the judges who were evaluating Mr. Ferguson at the time, and did they not specifically ask about whether he was under the influence of any drugs or alcohol so that it would affect his ability to properly waive?
I don't think that we're not arguing that he was under the influence of toluene or cocaine at the time he entered the plea. But at the time, he has been under various forms of medication for many years. And he was no longer being medicated to remain stable.
Is one of your objections that he was not evaluated by a psychiatrist and neurologist? Instead, he was evaluated by a psychologist.
Yes.
Wasn't that issue decided in Mink that a psychologist would be sufficient?
On the record in Mink, I think it was decided that way. But in Mink, Mr. Mink, there were no objections by the lawyers involved in Mink saying that he should have a psychiatrist. There were a number of objections in this case saying that he should have a psychiatrist. There was no affidavit on the level of the affidavit that was prepared to request psychiatric evaluation in the Mink case, as was here.
But the defense had a psychiatrist that certainly could, who examined Ferguson and could have called to the defense's attention any problems, which could then have been called to the court's attention.
Right, and what he did was he said, in order to properly give you that advice, I need to do these tests. Mm-hmm. And that was the purpose of the affidavit from Dr. Momsen. Dr. Momsen's affidavit is not really a report the way the clinical psychologist gave a report. It is saying, in order to give you a report, I need to do the following tests. And in fact, the court granted that motion, but it sort of disappeared into the nether world. And it was never, the only thing I could find was the absence of any payment records. And there was never any testimony or any referral to any of these tests ever being done. but there was nothing in the record that specifically said they weren't.
So you don't know whether the tests were done or not?
I don't know for certain. Given my knowledge.
Was the onus on the defense to facilitate the testing with their psychiatrist?
I believe it would have been, Your Honor.
And presumably, I mean, you have nothing to say that the tests were not done and not entered into any record because they may have been of no help to your client.
No, I don't believe the tests were physically ever done.
And you base that on what?
That there's no payment. Mr. Ferguson was represented by court-appointed counsel. The only way the test could have been done, the affidavit sets out a number of the costs of those tests. And they weren't, I mean, it was several thousand dollars.
Sure.
And there was no, within the court record, and the payment records are court orders, and there is no indication the tests were ever actually done. And I don't believe they were done.
But still, the burden would be on the defense to facilitate the testing that the court granted authority to do.
Yes, I would agree that it is on the defense.
Counsel, the psychiatrist indicated that he would need to do several tests in order to properly evaluate. Do you know, did the psychiatrist interview Mr. Ferguson at all?
Yes. Yes, he did interview him. And he the details of both the not the details, but he was interviewed by the psychiatrist, and he had access to
some records.
Oh, yes. Yeah. And he specifically identifies the records he was relying on. There were a number of hospitalizations at I believe, two different hospitals, plus Children's Hospital. Plus, I believe he had access to the psychiatrist, the neurologist, the treating neurologist, his records as well.
In fact, he interviewed, Dr. Bergman interviewed him for over 9 hours, and over a five-day period. This is not a cursory interview.
Well, it is, right. I'm not saying
sometimes
that.
Sometimes see a fairly cursory
right,
interview.
Right, right. I think in terms of the seriousness of the case and the absence of, for example, Dr. Bourbon gave three tests. One, a general intelligence test. Secondly, some sort of personality inventory, and then the MMPI. The MMPI came back with invalidity scales too high to make the test valid. So she really only had two tests to rely on in making whatever opinions she had.
Is our standard review here plain error? There was no objection made to the trial court's refusal to at the competency hearing to order a psychotherapist.
I believe, Your Honor, that it is not plain error. I believe in our brief we set forth the numerous times, including, I believe, at the competency hearing, in which his lawyers said, Your Honor, we object to the absence of a psychiatrist on this evaluation. I do not believe this is a plain error test, Your Honor.
Counsel, is it, is it wrong to infer when a psychiatrist has interviewed and tested to some extent, and then says, I need more tests to give you an answer. Couldn't one infer that the process that far had not indicated incompetency? Because if it was clearly indicated, wouldn't you stop and not demand more hours of the county's time and more money for tests? There wouldn't be any reason to go on. And is that a fair inference?
I don't think in this case it is. I think the lawyers continue to object to the absence. The affidavit from Dr. Momsen went into the record as investigation for mitigation. Now, whether he would have found him, then at the time that was made, the issue of pleading guilty and waiving mitigation was not a matter before the court. And so I think had they might have phrased the analysis a little bit differently, but he's clearly saying he needs additional information to check for brain damage. There were some very specific issues he wanted identified.
But there was nothing in the initial analysis by the psychiatrist to say, indicia of incompetency, I need these further testing to confirm my diagnosis or my evaluation. It was unanswered at that point.
Right. Dr. Momsen did not make a diagnosis at that point. He wanted the additional testing done before he made his diagnosis.
Right, but he didn't even lay a foundation that there's indicia of incompetency and further testing is warranted. It was kind of, I need this arsenal of tests in order to form an opinion.
Right, right. He has not given an opinion on competency.
So would you, are you looking for a rule here to be established by this court that when there's a prescription for psychotropic medications, only a psychiatrist is the medical expert to conduct testing towards the question of incompetency or ability to waive rights and never a psychologist?
I think that when the trial lawyers are objecting and saying, Judge, we need that a psychiatrist is needed to make the kind of evaluation of the impact of chemicals on our client's thought processes, that a clinical psychologist is out of their scope of practice. Now, it may be that when the lawyers do not make the objections, as was the case in the Mink, that the court can rely upon the information. But it's clear here that not only did you have voluntary medication, toluene and cocaine, plus other drugs as well, but you had psychotropic medication over most of his life. So that this is not a situation in the Mink case where we were talking about, I believe, depression.
So just for clarification, when the defense attorneys request a psychiatrist and there have been prescriptions issued with regard to the defendant, you would like a rule of law stating that only a psychiatrist will do?
Yeah, I believe that the psychiatrists are the ones who are trained to make medical decisions. And I think this is a medical decision as opposed to a psychological decision.
Although right now the definition of examiner under 294537 states that we're talking about either a psychiatrist or the licensed clinical psychologist.
Right, I'm not saying that every case you have you can do that, or even every case where there are some kind of medication. What I'm saying is that where you're reviewing it this is not a plain error review such as was in the Mink case. And here you have an extensive psychiatric history. He had a treating neurologist from childhood. And the court was willing to make, and the court here made a determination about his competency without having any information. He was being treated for bipolar disorder, for example.
But the only trigger for incompetency is the fact that he wouldn't allow mitigation evidence.
Well, the question of competency is whether or not he had the mental, whether the test for competency constitutionally is a defendant may not be put to trial unless he has sufficient present ability to consult with his lawyer with a reasonable degree of rational understanding.
And the fact that he did not allow his attorneys to introduce mitigation evidence here is what triggered the question, is he competent to do
right.
that?
Yeah, I'm sorry.
But the attorneys are not saying that he was not assisting in the preparation of the case. They couldn't interview him. He was so psychotic or out of touch with what was going on. He understood. There's no allegations, there's no affidavits that he didn't understand what was going on here.
I think that it has to do with when you're talking about long-term mental illness, a bipolar disorder, for example. The psychologist, the interesting thing is the similarities between the psychological reports of both Mr. Mink and Mr. Ferguson. They read quite the same. But when you look at the history of the case and the involvement and the diagnosis, an ongoing diagnosis of bipolar disorder, for example, the clinical psychologist, it's not in her expertise, and she never talked about what impact.
When did he go off of his, in relation to the murders, when did he go off of his psychotropic drugs?
It is, again, I'm not sure. This kind of information was not tracked.
We really don't know whether he went off or...
He was at least on the medications at the time he left he was in a halfway house in Cincinnati.
Okay, and he was on his medications.
He was on the medication on, I believe, a Monday.
And he certainly was on his medications when he was in jail and dealing with his attorneys.
Part of the time he was on the medications. At the time these decisions were being made, he was not on medications.
Okay. The only thing that he added to his medications was crack cocaine.
Or toluene. I don't remember which medication, which drug he was on at the time of the homicides. But he had also, while it's unclear, it seems to me clear from Mr. Ferguson did not authorize much in the way of cross-examination. But it was interesting, the thing he authorized, and there was cross-examination on it, it's cited in the brief, is when his probation officer from Cincinnati was testifying at the hearing, he was asked about whether or not they sent his medications home. And I was probably a little more aggressive than I should have been when I cited it in the brief. But the record, Mr. Ferguson wanted that before the court. And he asked the probation officer, isn't it true that you didn't send his medications home with him? The response was, I don't have that information. That's the first time I had that information. It was not clear whether or not when he left the mental health or the facility in Cincinnati, whether his medications went with him. So the 3 or 4 days in between, he may not have had the medications.
From a procedural standpoint, the attorneys entered these requests after the plea and the finding of guilt, did they not?
I believe so. I believe they objected at every opportunity.
Prior to entering the plea?
Yes. Yeah. They at one point the judge agreed that a psychiatrist was appropriate for the evaluation, and then again it's not clear from the record why, but he changed his mind. Only a single clinical psychologist was there. There was some discussion about whether or not there had to be agreement with the government whether or not a psychiatrist could be appointed. And then there was our brief cites the specific instances.
I thought you believed your stronger position is to argue that sentencing needs to be overturned.
I wasn't as clear on that. I believe that the sentencing determinations and the plea determinations were made at the same within a couple of days of each other. I mean, there wasn't the opportunity. The big gap in time was the gap between when the clinical psychologist made her evaluation in May and when the actual hearings on plea and sentencing occurred, I believe, late August, early September.
Did Dr. Mossman ever testify?
No, he never testified.
Counsel, you're not advancing the theory that because the trial court granted the defense motion for a psychiatrist and these testing, that it invalidated or said that the clinical psychologist was not to be used.
No, I'm not saying that. The decision about the order on the testing, I believe, was done in late winter. February, I believe, maybe early March. I don't remember.
So this,
that was when that decision was made. Shortly after that, Mr. Ferguson requested to plead guilty and waive mitigation. There was some discussion about having a psychiatrist appointed to the evaluation. The court realized it needed some evaluation. And so there was some discussion about whether or not a psychiatrist would be involved. Ultimately, a single clinical psychologist performed the evaluation.
But there was authority for a psychiatrist to be involved had the defense followed through?
No. There was never a psychiatrist appointed for the evaluation. There was discussion of that, but there was never a psychiatrist appointed for that evaluation, and it was that objection that was made a number of times throughout the process.
But the court granted the motion for the testing to assist Dr. Mossman in an evaluation.
Right, but the evaluation, that was being done in preparation for mitigation. It was not done as part of a competency evaluation. But the court had before it the factual information that Dr. Mommsen put out of the various diagnoses, the various suicide attempts, the various hospitalizations, that sort of thing. That information was before the court.
You would back this up procedurally. You would have us send this all back and essentially start over at the plea stage? And would that include the ability to plead not guilty by reason of insanity and all of that as well?
I believe so, Your Honor. The timing on it is such that
a total start over.
The timing on it is such that I don't think there is a way to distinguish between the sentencing and the plea, because they were done right at the same time. There was no intervening evaluation.
The only evidence that was before the court on competency was that your client was competent to enter the plea. There was no contradicting evidence at that time. Am I correct about that?
That's correct. There wasn't
So what you're asking us to do is infer that because the psychiatrist didn't have the opportunity to perform all of the tests, or for some reason those tests weren't performed for the mitigation phase, that we should somehow transmit that back to the competency phase and say that the plea that was entered is invalid, even though there's no evidence to contradict the competency finding that was made by the trial court based on the psychologist's testimony. Am I right?
There was an objection at the competency hearing to the failure to have a psychiatrist on the evaluation team.
But there was no contradicting evidence presented at that time.
Because the person that could have presented that contradictory evidence would have been a psychiatrist.
But we didn't know that because the tests weren't performed for the sentencing phase, which was a later point in time.
No, the court knew it because the defense counsel kept objecting.
So you think the objection to the opportunity to have the psychiatrist voids the evidence of competency?
Yes. The information that a psychiatrist would have presented was not available to the court when it made its determination.
Is there any indication that that report could have been proffered that would have contradicted the evidence offered of the psychiatrist?
There is no report because there was never an evaluation.
So we really don't even know that the evidence, if in fact it were there, would be contradictory, do we?
Right, we don't know.
So you want us to avoid a determination by a clinical psychologist made in accordance with 29-45-37, who is proper to make that, should be contradicted by maybe there'll be some other testimony that might contradict it. How do we run courts around Ohio on such, maybe it'll be there?
Well, when you have clinical psychologists who make competency evaluations without discussing bipolar disorder, things like that, the confidence in such determinations is not very high. When you have the kinds of indication of significant involvement with psychotropic medication and no discussion in the competency evaluation.
We run courts based on evidence.
Right.
You have no evidence.
And the failure of I am here on the failure of the trial court to appoint a psychiatrist to that evaluation team. That
are you not asking us to adopt some rule, some threshold, that in a death penalty case, when there are indications of psychiatric problems at the early stage, that we should, even though the statute says the clinical psychologist satisfies the statute or the test, that there should be a higher standard in a death case, and that when there are indicators that the person needs to be examined more thoroughly than he or she has been examined, that we should set a threshold. Am I overstating here? I'm trying to draw what your argument is.
I think that there is a point where, and it's a continuum. And I think when you take the Mink case, that is a case where I think that the involvement of the clinical psychologist there would not have warranted, and there were no objections to a psychiatrist not being there. Here, where you have the defense lawyer saying we need a psychiatrist, and you have the evidence, albeit not focused on competency, but clearly establishing that there was a bipolar disorder that he had been treated for over a long period of time, that he had a treating physician up until the time of his arrest. You know, when you have an involvement of a physician, the statute in Ohio that talks about clinical psychologists giving opinions says that when they get involved in medical stuff, they're supposed to go talk to a doctor and find out. Now, there's no indication in her report that she consulted anyone or that she had this working relationship.
You've used your time, Mr. Krim. Ms. Ingram.
Mr. Chief Justice, and may it please the Court, I'm here today to ask this Court to affirm the conviction and sentence and to find in its own independent analysis that the aggravating circumstances outweigh the mitigating factors beyond a reasonable doubt, to find that the sentence of death is proportionate and to impose a death sentence. I think to properly understand the issue that—
Excuse me. I think if you'd pull the microphone closer to you, you will be able to hear
it. I'll try again. Thank you. Mm-hmm. I think in order to understand the issue that Mr. Krim brings to the Court, it's important to understand the structure of the case below as regards the appointment of an expert. From March of 2002, the date of the indictment, until March of 2003, this case was proceeding as if it were going to trial as a capital case. In connection with that, experienced counsel filed a number of motions, including a motion for a mental health expert, and including a motion for a particular number of psychiatric tests, the ones we've named, the EEG, the CAT scan, the lumbar puncture, the PET scan, and the neuropsychological testing, and asked that they be conducted at particular places. This was hotly contested, but the judge eventually granted that, and it was set up for him to have those tests. Now, I would ask you to read Dr. Mossman's affidavit. The affidavit specifically says that I was asked to assume that he's been found guilty and to approach or to consider these factors and how they would affect mitigation in evaluating what kind of tests I would recommend. So the question before Dr. Mossman, when that came to him, was what is there that might affect mitigation if this man were found guilty? And the case proceeded that far. So he was looking for information, or the inquiry was directed to those kinds of things that wouldn't make him not culpable, but that would weigh against a death penalty. Shortly after the Court granted that motion, at a status conference with defendant present, he announced through his attorneys that he wanted to plead guilty and he wanted to waive mitigation. About a week or so after that, a second conference was held, and the court itself made the suggestion of incompetence, discussed at that time what kind of experts were to be appointed, and eventually the court appointed Dr. Bergman. Now, it is true that at those initial conversations, even throughout the course of the trial and even at sentencing, defense counsel continued to ask for the appointment of a psychiatrist. But at that point, when he waived his when he announced his intention to waive mitigation, at that point, the inquiry wasn't then, what can you find in mitigation? It was, is this man, is this defendant, first competent to enter guilty pleas and competent to waive the evaluation, which is a different kind of question that Dr. Mossman was initially asked. So he was sent to Dr. Bergman, who spent 9.5 hours with him, produced a 22-page report, and based her eventual conclusion on an elaborate family history, review of medical records, discussions with him about what kinds of medications he was taking, his history, his education level. In addition, she did IQ tests. She sat across the desk from him and assessed his behavior, gave an opinion as to whether or not he was rational, could answer questions. All of those things, plus, although the MMPI wasn't included because it appeared to be an invalid profile, she did a different personality inventory and concluded that he was competent to enter a guilty plea and he was competent to waive mitigation.
And she is a person qualified under the statute to do such an evaluation.
She is. And the record doesn't show an objection to her being appointed as an expert, only that there should have also been a psychiatrist.
And your basic argument is that when the court granted that, the defense attorneys were couching the request for the psychiatrist in terms of, we need this for mitigation.
That's correct. And also, I will say that those tests weren't done. I direct you to page 1101 or 1102 of the transcript, where defense counsel tells the court right before sentence is imposed, you know, we tried to talk him out of this. We did everything we could because we didn't think this case should proceed this way. And in fact, we even got him to cooperate for a little time and to agree with this testing with Dr. Mossman. But when he made up his mind that he wanted to waive mitigation, he said, no, 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 let's put an end to that. So I think it's clear that he was talking about the testing, maybe not the interview, because it was shortly before or after that the defense counsel renewed his request for a psychiatrist.
Did Mossman interview him then, or what was he was interviewed?
Mossman interviewed him for, I think, just over 4 hours.
Okay.
To produce that affidavit that was directed toward mitigation. So the court granted that. It generated certain kinds of areas that he said, if I'm to opine on mitigation, this is the kind of information I need. All of a sudden, that was off the table, and the question was competence to enter a plea and competence to waive mitigation. Neither the record nor Dr. Bergman's report nor the court's conclusions tend to show that the defendant was anything but competent.
Once he made the decision to switch, that is Ferguson, did the lawyers then switch tactics and say, well, we wonder about his ability to make this decision, so we need the psychiatrist now, not for mitigation, but for competency?
Your Honor, I would direct you to the motion that they filed for a second opinion. I don't know the answer to that as I stand here. I believe that if they did that, that would be there. I will also say that there are a couple places in the record where counsel says to the court, Your Honor, I have been over this with him. We have reviewed this, and I believe when you talk to him about it right now, he will understand. So counsel never made an overt suggestion that he was anything but competent.
Mr. Krim is arguing that there were objections at the time of the competency finding by the trial court, by Mr. Ferguson's counsel, to the fact that they didn't have an expert.
Yes, and I think that's probably at page 1101 or 1102, where one of the attorneys said, I would renew the request for a psychiatrist. But counsel also says, in that same general area, we tried to get him to change his mind. For a while, we even got him to cooperate to the extent of having this testing with Dr. Mossman. But when he decided he wanted to waive, he said, no, let's put a stop to that.
Did I understand you correctly to say that there is a representation by counsel that he was competent to make these determinations?
There is no representation where counsel affirmatively says that. Counsel never, on the record, challenged his competence, and on a couple of occasions informed the court, Your Honor, I have discussed this with him. When you talk to him now, I believe he will understand you.
So when the trial court made its determination, the only evidence contained in the record came from the psychologist with respect to the fact that based on 9 hours of examination, he was competent.
And the court's observation of the defendant in numerous hearings in court where he, up until the very end of trial, conducted himself appropriately, showed respect for the court, answered questions logically and rationally, and explained his rationale one time by saying, I want to make sure this is done right, because I don't want to have this come back and do it again, and later saying, I know my family doesn't want me to do this, but they don't have to do the time. I do. So that in addition to just the doctor's report, the court also had the benefit of seeing the defendant numerous times in court and seeing that he behaved rationally and that he explained to the court, he gave the court a rational explanation for the choice he made.
Are you starting to see more and more requests for these type of testing in these death penalty cases? I mean, I've looked at a couple lately, and it seems like the neuropsych test seems to keep popping up as something defense counsel are now requesting.
This is the third case that I believe that it's come up in Montgomery County, and I think it is something that we will continue to see. And when I stand here and argue that it was not appropriate on the facts of this case, I'm not saying that it might, that it would never be appropriate. There may well be a case when that kind of testing is appropriate. However, there's nothing in the record here. There's no showing that this defendant was anything but competent.
Counsel, the taking you outside of this case or beyond this case to the final destiny of Mr. Ferguson, is the standard and the test for competency to be put to death the same as the standard for competency to stand trial?
The inquiry is different, and this court set out the questions that you're asking, but essentially they boil down to the same question. Does this person really understand what he's asking to do? Does he understand what it means? Does he understand the consequences? Does he understand the alternatives? And is he voluntarily making that choice? And the standard, the ultimate question is the same. The different kinds of areas are different. And in going back to a question that was sort of brought up in the other argument about whether or not a heightened scrutiny for competence to waive in a death penalty case ought to be applied, I'd ask the court to look again at Ashworth, where that was raised, and also I believe Mink too.
Okay. Go ahead.
I'm sorry. The protections for the defendant are built into that, and there's simply no showing that there needs to be greater scrutiny in these kinds of cases, or that the framework for inquiry that the court set up is inadequate to determine whether a particular defendant really has or lacks the capability to make that choice rationally.
The reason I ask is it would seem if they are about the same, it would make more sense to give the heightened scrutiny before the trial than to get all the way down and now appeals and more time and resources expended only to find that this person really isn't going to be capable of being competent to be put to death. So that's a process question in a more global sense rather than just this case.
And I think I understand what you're saying. For example, if you did the first inquiry as to competence and found him competent to enter the plea, then went into the second part, which, if there were to be a stricter standard, well, he's competent to have entered that plea, but he's not competent to waive mitigation. I agree with you. If that were the rule, then the process might have to be changed.
No, but I'm going on down the line to be put to death. If this person is, if we were to say, well, we need to be more careful about the ultimate execution, wouldn't the place to put the high standard be at the front end rather than
yes.
at the back
yes,
end?
Yes, I agree. I agree that if that were the case, that's...
And then the second thing that seems to trouble me personally more as we look at these is the notion, and I think that's where our jurisprudence is at this point, that we can medicate someone who is otherwise incompetent to be put to death up to the level of competency to be put to death. In other words, we medicate them up to the level that now, while they're with the medicine, they're competent to be put to death. That, there seems to me to be something philosophically troubling about that concept. You care to comment, or?
I remember being in my second year of law school at Ohio State, and one of the professors made the very same point, that a person may have been competent to be tried and tried not guilty by reason of insanity, become incompetent after conviction, facing a death penalty, and the law says they must be brought to competence simply so that you can execute them. That was an anomaly, according to the, and it may just be an imperfection in the system, but not one that's so great, I don't think, to overturn it.
That argument has been made in many cases, the fact that we put people on psychotropic drugs in order to make them competent, in order to execute them.
Yes, Your Honor.
But we have never found that to be present any type of error.
No, and I don't think that the Supreme Court of the United States has found that either. And I know that there was a case out of Arkansas that brought that up, and the court didn't take that case.
Well, counsel, that's not the issue here. Nobody forced Mr. Ferguson.
No.
In fact, there is some indication here that even off his drugs, his psychotropic medications, and without the influence of crack or
toil. That's what easier.
Right. That there was no problem with his thought process.
No. In fact, he had been off his psychotropic drugs, according to Dr. Bergman, 2.5 months when she did the evaluation.
And by his own admission, when he was off them, he could think more clearly, and that was his representation.
That's correct.
And the side effects, obviously, of taking psychotropics without the balancing drugs that go along with to eradicate those side effects, at times you could understand where he, off the medication, was thinking more clearly for the short term to make these decisions. And when questioned by the, and especially in a controlled environment such as the prison, awaiting trial.
Right.
So there's no indicia that the test that the psychiatrist and, you know, through the defense counsel was requesting were going to show any kind of an impact on the guilt phase or the mitigation phase here. And I'm going back to my question to Mr. Krim, is the only thing that triggered this was his reluctance to present any mitigating evidence. There was no attorney affidavit saying that I can't communicate with this defendant, that he's not assisting us in the preparation of his case, that he's not understanding the big picture or the immediate picture. There were none of the typical triggers that an attorney, a defense team, could present to the court and would mandate to the court that there be a psych eval.
Exactly. And Ashworth doesn't require that the inquiry involve a psychologist out of an abundance of caution. In this case, the court ordered that.
Exactly.
And I think it was a good thing. I'm not disagreeing that the court shouldn't have done that in this kind of case, but that it was not required. There was no particular trigger for it. And again, in the record, the defendant is asked repeatedly about how he gets along with his attorneys and does he understand, and he explained that he does.
So the when I asked Mr. Krim about what kind of rule of law, and I guess the statement is that when you've got a defendant with this type of history of mental treatment, mental illness treatment, drug consumption, both prescribed and illegal, and there's a request by the defense that there always has to be a psychiatrist, do you see any foundation for that
None. And I would not foreclose a defendant ever getting a psychiatrist in that sure. situation, but that there must be a showing that that psychiatrist can offer something to the court in its competency evaluation or its competency determination that the psychologist cannot do, that there is a benefit to be had, and it has to be based on evidence, not it would be great if somebody could address the chemical effects of Risperdal on the brain.
So you're saying that Mr. Krim's suggestion that a simple objection by the defense when this is being decided by the trial court is insufficient?
I think that would be insufficient, but I do believe that they preserved they asked for it at the outset. I believe they filed a motion specifically asking for it and asking for a specific doctor and then preserved it. So it would be insufficient, but in this case, I do believe that the objection itself or the complaint was preserved.
Mm-hmm. Okay, thank you.
I'd ask the court in its independent evaluation to weigh the aggravating circumstances that this man was found guilty of against the mitigating factors. He knocked on doors of people that knew him and would let them in. He not only beat them, he kicked them, he stomped them, he stabbed them, he left bloody footprints on their clothing and cheeks, and he left them. He confessed right away. He said he knew he did wrong, but he showed no remorse. The facts that the court relied on below for mitigation, the court was correct. They mitigate only slightly. In this case, it's the state's position, and the state asks this court to so find that the aggravating circumstances outweigh the mitigating factors beyond a reasonable doubt and to impose a sentence of death on Darrell Wayne Ferguson. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Ingram. Mr. Krim, you've used your time, but you may take 30 seconds.
I thought I had a minute. I think the evidence in this case would show that Mr. Ferguson did suffer from bipolar disorder. And it seems to me that a mental evaluation, when you have a physician saying he suffers from a bipolar disorder, that a clinical psychologist who doesn't find any bipolar disorder, that kind of incongruity between the evidence of bipolar disorder found by a physician and a clinical psychologist doesn't find it, requires, in this case, the trial court to make an inquiry into the bipolar disorder and the effect. This would have been resolved by the appointment of a psychiatrist.
Counsel, the trial court clearly could have ordered all of this.
Right.
What is our standard for review when the trial court orders something that satisfies the statute but perhaps does not satisfy?
I believe the trial court acted unreasonably here, that the evidence before it of having a physician say he suffers from bipolar disorder and having a clinical psychologist saying, no, he doesn't.
At what point did the physician make that statement to the court?
It was in the affidavit of Dr. Momsen. It was there were repeated references, both I believe in both Dr. Momsen's and I believe the clinical psychologist acknowledged that he'd been diagnosed as bipolar.
I thought you just said that the psychiatrist, the physician diagnosed it, but the psychologist didn't find it.
The psychologist...
You're saying there's a dichotomy between the two, or there isn't?
The psychologist acknowledged that the physicians had diagnosed him as bipolar. That is not something.
And that evidence was before the trial court.
Yes, that was before the trial court.
And the witness who testified was the psychologist.
Okay, I'm assuming that the affidavit from Dr. Momsen is evidence before the trial court. And that was information that the trial court had.
So the court considered all of the evidence.
Yes.
And Dr. Mossman did not testify.
No, he did not testify, other than by affidavit.
And then the court made its determination.
Mr. Krim, there is, at least I'm off on Justice Pfeiffer's track on this. As you probably know, there was a case a few years ago, the name of which I've forgotten, which I dissented, and when I said that I believe that we should do as another state had done, and that is to provide for a competency hearing whenever a death penalty defendant refuses the help of counsel and it just won't, you know, says put me to death. I'm still in a distinct minority, I think, on that view. But do you know of any state that has adopted a rule, either by statute or by court decision, that would say in a case such as this, where there are a number of indicators that at the plea stage, that there are a number of indicators that this person is mentally ill, that the court should order a competency hearing with a full competency hearing, such as the kind of evaluation that you, is any state, any death penalty state done that?
Your Honor, I am unaware of that. I have not researched that at the national level.
Thank you, Mr. Grimm. The case is submitted. You'll be advised of our opinion.